Okay, good morning, everyone. First of all, thank you, Esty, for hosting us. We appreciate it. Hopefully we'll be back at my house next week, but we're doing some painting inside, and I was told we're not having this class at our house. So, thank you, Esty, last minute. Appreciate it. Anyone who's not on the email list, let me know so I can add you so we can let you know. I thought with Yom HaShoah tonight and tomorrow, and I'll remind you, we have a very powerful Yom HaShoah program planned this year, as we do every year, beginning with a live hookup with our teenagers and Rabbi Brody, who are in Poland right now on March of the Living, and a very powerful speaker, one of the youngest survivors of the Holocaust, who was a child in Auschwitz, will be speaking tonight, and then the viewing of a very powerful film. But with Yom HaShoah tonight, I thought we would talk in our weekly dose of Emunah, injection of Emunah, Chizik for Emunah, to talk a little bit about the Holocaust. And it's I don't intend to go to dangerous waters of Emunah and the Holocaust, because the Holocaust, of course, raises all kinds of theological questions, what's called theodicy, why do bad things happen to good people, and they raise it in a magnitude which is perhaps unprecedented and hopefully something which will never be repeated. I remember I took a course at YU with a professor who actually was a former roommate of my father, named Stephen Katz. He's from Boston, and he's written countless books on the Holocaust, and the thesis of his books is that the Holocaust is categorically different than any other genocide or any other tragedy in human history. It's not just on a different magnitude, it's categorically different than anything. And I remember debating him about this question. In other words, if the question essentially from a theological standpoint is bad things happen to good people, is there a difference other than magnitude when you talk about a baby who drowns? Why do bad things happen to good people? And 6 million. The magnitude, its impact is more devastating, of course. But conceptually, it reduces to the same question, which is, if there's an omnipotent, omniscient, good, caring, compassionate, loving God, how could he either do this, or why would he allow it? But that's an area I don't want to go to, because I don't think there are questions to it. I don't think there are answers to it, rather. And the question is stronger than the answer. Instead, I want to look at the Holocaust on the eve of Yom HaShoah, not to try to solve that theological dilemma and prove to you that we should have faith because of the Holocaust, but rather to use the Holocaust as a platform to talk about our survivors. And there were survivors, with no doubt, whose faith was shaken to its core, who walked away, who abandoned their faith, and of course, we don't sit in judgment with them whatsoever. We have no opinion. We have only admiration and love and esteem for what they endured and how they survived. But we have survivors. We had, and we have survivors who maintain their faith despite the horrific atrocities that they experienced, despite the unimaginable suffering they endured, despite the loss that they experienced. And nevertheless, with all of that, they maintain their faith. And to me, that is a reservoir, that is something to tap into that we yet have available to us. We don't know how much longer we will, but to see survivors who put on tefillin or light Shabbos candles, who open a siddur and daven, who maintain any level of observance, any level of faith, is something which could and should give us the strongest sense of chizuk. That when we have moments of doubt and uncertainty, when we feel, where is God and how could he have abandoned us because of the issues or challenges we're going through, to be able to look at these survivors. I remember once teaching a group of teenage boys, and a couple of them told me they were struggling with faith, and some said they were actually not struggling, they were absolutely certain that they were atheist or agnostic. There's no God, it's, you know, the Big Bang and this and that, and there's no God. And I remember Rabbi Klein, Zichrono Livracha, was alive, and I said to these boys who were growing up in our community and watched Rabbi Klein each and every Shabbos and received candies from him as young children and saw his life, I said, I'm not asking you to believe in God because Rabbi Klein does. I'm not saying that you should take the leap because Rabbi Klein took it. But what I'm saying to you is that you're 14, 15 years old. Is it possible that Rabbi Klein, who's 90, and who lost a spouse and children in Auschwitz, and who nevertheless went on to rebuild a life where he tried to bring people close to Torah and mitzvot and Hashem, is it possible he knows something you don't? Is it possible that there's something to learn from it, or that you should just suspend judgment? You'll decide later. Rabbi Klein is enough of a reason to say you're not so certain there's no God. If he could believe in God with what he went through. I won't tell you what they answered, which is reflective of the millennial generation that we are dealing with today. But that's where I draw chizuk from. Every day I see Martin Judavis. Every day I interact with survivors. So that's what I wanted to talk about today in terms of Emunah through that prism. And to do so through an outstanding sefer. And by the way, I'll just say as an aside, I don't remember if I shared this with you before, that there are survivors who didn't maintain one act of observance of Torah and mitzvos, who I still think there's incredible faith to learn from. I will never forget a funeral that I officiated at. I was assistant rabbi, so it goes back to when I had hair. And I spoke to the woman's family. And I'm preparing for the funeral. I'd never met her. I didn't know her. So I have a series of questions I ask to try to elicit information, try to get to know the person. And one of the questions I asked was, what was her relationship with her Judaism like? You know, given her history, given that she was a survivor, how did she connect to her Judaism? How did she connect to God? And the son-in-law said to me, he said, I never thought about it, but I'll tell you, she believed in God incredibly. And how do I know that? Because she was so angry at God her whole life. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you're not angry at someone that you don't believe exists. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not angry at someone that's a figment of imagination. You're not angry at somebody who you had no expectation of. Right? If a stranger on the street didn't help you in your time of need, you wouldn't be disappointed in them. But if your parent failed you, you'd be terribly disappointed and angry at them. Why? Because you have tremendous expectation and love. So he taught me an amazing lesson that her lifelong anger to God was in actuality an amazing expression of faith. So there's an amuna of drawing close, and there's even an amuna of anger, which is not a model of amuna that we teach or endorse, but it reflects a level of amuna as well. So Yom HaShoah was chosen. The whole history of Yom HaShoah we're not going to go into right now. Yom HaShoah's real name in Israel is Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura. It's not Yom HaShoah. And the reason it's called Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, Yom HaShoah, Shoah, we all know what it means. Hagvura means end of strength. A gibor is a warrior, a strong person. Why is it called Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura? Because what does tomorrow's date coincide with on the Jewish calendar? The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it was chosen for this date to reflect, it's a kind of very Israeli mentality of not wanting to emphasize, like sheep to the slaughter, a passive experience, but that we had resistance. And there's a lot of emphasis of physical resistance in the Holocaust. But there was an extraordinary amount of spiritual resistance in the Holocaust. And spiritual resistance means that even when one didn't take up arms or fight back physically, but the unwillingness to abandon their spiritual identity, spiritual ambition, spiritual pursuit, even in the face, even in that dark, dark dungeon of Gehenna, that's a spiritual resistance which deserves our attention, our awe, and to be inspired by as well. And the place I turn to be inspired by that spiritual resistance is an incredible set of Sfarim called Shailos U'Tshuvos Mimamakim. It's on page 1. Shailos U'Tshuvos Mimamakim, that's the cover page. It was written by Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. Rav Oshri died in 2003. He was born in 1914. Rav Oshri was the Rav of the Kovna Ghetto. I don't think that was a job he applied for. I'm not saying he went through a faher, but it was by default, a de facto job. He was a Talmud Chacham. People started coming to him to ask them questions in the ghetto itself, and he answered. And he didn't have access to Sfarim and libraries. He didn't have the luxury of sitting down and investigating and researching. But he was a great Talmud Chacham. So he wrote down their questions and their answers. And he buried them in the Kovna Ghetto. And he later was able to go back after surviving and he retrieved them. And he ultimately in 1959 published those questions and answers under the response of the title Shailos U'Tshuvos Mimamakim. Mimamakim comes from the Perek of Tehillim, Kuf Lamed, Mimamakim Krasicha El Hashem. From the depths I call out to you, God. David HaMelech says, Mimamakim, from the depths. I feel like I am in such a low, dark place, and I am calling out to you from the depths. In fact, the Ramah, there's a Sif in Shulchan Aruch that says, very few shuls are designed this way, but that actually where the chazan stands should not be elevated on a bima, but actually should be in the ground. You should take a step down, because the chazan should physically be a manifestation of this mimamakim, from the depths I'm calling out of you. Our students at March of the Living in Krakow will go to the Ramah Shul of Moshe Isserles, and in the Ramah Shul you'll see that the place where the Chazan stands is actually a step down. So it's very appropriate title that Rav Oshri chose, mimamakim, from the depths. These tshuvas were written from the depths, right? If you were to write tshuvas in America, it would be about, what's the halacha? Can the non-Jew carry my 14 suitcases to the hotel for Pesach and make the quinoa? Right? The tshuvas of America in 2016 are not mimamakim. This is the tshuvas mimamakim. Rav Oshri was an incredible individual. As I said, he survived. He retrieved and published 1959. Ultimately, there's 5 volumes of mimamakim. Some of them were translated into an abridged form and into one volume. And you see there's a little bio here on page 1, that after being liberated, he married his wife, who was a survivor. They went to Rome. He started a yeshiva as an orphanage for refugee children. 1950, he took them all to Montreal. Then they came to New York in 1952. They became the rabbi of the Beis Medrash HaGadol. He opened a boys' yeshiva, a girls' school in East Bronx. And Yeshiva Shar Ephraim in Muncie is named after him and run by his son-in-law. He was the Rav in the Kovna ghetto. And I want to share with you, I want to learn with you this tshuva about a question he was asked, which is an amazing embodiment of spiritual resistance. And again, it's one example of 5 volumes of questions that were asked, that if they could maintain that faith in that time, in that place, in that circumstance, I'm not saying that's a reason that we should have faith, but I'm saying if you have faith, that certainly strengthens it. That if your faith is a little shaken by some challenges you're going through, looking at our survivors, knowing our survivors, seeing these tshuvos and these spiritual resistance, for me, is a source of preserving the faith. We'll read it through a little bit in the Hebrew, though I do have the translation. It's an abridged translation on page 4 from the English version of it. He's referencing a pasuk, right, that my head is flowing with water, tears, that they were killed and butchered and burnt in sanctifying God's name through the evil, wicked Germans. Their name should be erased. I remember the black day, as the Jews of the Kovna ghetto designated that day. It was called the Yom HaShachor, it was called the Black Day. Yom Chesla Chodesh Mar Cheshvan Tovshin Beis, the 8th of Mar Cheshvan, 5702, corresponding with October 29th, 1941. Nafshi Alay Tismogeg, V'libi Namas Bekirbi Al Harag Anashim Noshim Lataf, that my heart is so pained, it melts in my insides, so many men, women, and children were murdered. Zekenim Ne'orim, I know it's abridged in the English, I'm translating from the Hebrew. The older with the young. Yonkim va'olule tapuchim bizros imos rachmanios. You had nursing children, children who were in the arms of their mothers who were nursing. Kulam nisfu bideh ha'uyev asher lo yada rachem. They all fell at the hands of the enemy who knew no compassion. I think that's a play on words there. Rachem, compassion, and Rechem is the womb. He's referencing these nursing mothers, the characteristic of a woman. Her womb, which of course doesn't define her, but her womb, which is something that is unique to her. In Judaism, or in Torah, the uterus, the womb, is called the Rechem, which is from the same word as Rachamim. The maternal instinct of compassion, right? The maternal instinct, the womb, of compassion. So I think this is a play on word, that the mothers had children in their arms, and the enemy knew no compassion. Harag v'lochamol v'ravei dam nikiyem tahorim v'kedoshim. At the Seder this year, you know, I think the Seder night is a time that you tell the family narrative and you tell what happened. And so I know that there are survivors who never spoke about the Holocaust all year long, but at the Seder was the one night of the whole year that there was a window, a glimpse into what they did. So this year at the Seder, we were talking before you got here. What? I don't know. But Yocheved's whole family was together, and we asked my father-in-law. Unfortunately, his parents were survivors but are no longer here. So to tell, you know, we wanted our children. It was the whole family was together. Imagine our 26 grandchildren to hear about their great-grandparents. So he told the story that I don't know if any of us had known. He told a few stories which were extraordinary, but he told one story that at the birth of one of his children, I don't know if it was Yocheved or one of her siblings, they made a kiddush his parents made a kiddush in Rigo Park where they lived. It was a shul of all survivors, of all Hungarian survivors. They made a kiddush. I remember when we got engaged, we went for a Shabbos, they made a kiddush. I almost lost my tongue that Shabbos because the piece of herring almost made my tongue shrivel up and fall out of my mouth. That's where the kiddush of these survivors was a pile. This was the kiddush, a pile of salt and a bottle of shivas. And you had to swallow the salt and wash it down with the shivas and the bow tie. I almost didn't make it through the weekend. Anyway, so they made a kiddush when they had a grandchild, and my in-laws were there that Shabbos, and an older man came over to my father-in-law and said, "You know, you have me to thank for being here." So what are you talking about? You to think? What do you mean? What does that mean? He said, "You know, when your mother came to Auschwitz, both of his parents had previously been married with a child. So when your mother came to Auschwitz and she came off the train, she came from Hungary, which was towards the end of the war, and he had been from Poland. So he had been in Auschwitz for a long time, and his job was to one of the people unloading the train and getting the people on the line for the selection. So he saw." Yecheved's grandmother was with her mother-in-law and was with her five-year-old daughter in her arms. So he said to her, because he knew the way it worked, and this was towards the end of the war, they were especially efficient, that older people were immediately sent to the gas chambers, children were sent to the gas chambers, and a mother with a child, rather than go through the chaos of trying to separate them, just a mother holding a child was also sent to the line for the gas chamber. So he said to her, "Give your daughter to your mother-in-law now. Give her right now to your mother-in-law." And that's what happened. And the mother-in-law and the daughter were taken to the gas chamber. Mm-hmm. And because she didn't have, she survived. So he said, to my father-in-law, "You have me to thank for being here." So my father-in-law went to his parents and said, "I never met this guy. Is that story true?" They said, "Not only is the story true, but we invite him to every simcha. That's why he's here, because we've invited him to every simcha since." So what he's describing is the mother is holding the children. These stories are unimaginable. And then having to live with the guilt that you gave up your child. Mm. You survived, but you didn't go to the end while holding your child. These stories are unbelievable. Mm. Yecheved's grandparents were people of, despite having gone through that, you talk about emunah and faith and perseverance and really, really righteous, special, unbelievable people. As so many of our survivors. As bayomahu yatsa hatzav ha-natzim ha-arurim. So on that day, that black day, October 29th, 1941, the command went out from the Nazis, hademokrati, that on that day, without any exception, everyone living in the ghetto had to line up. Everyone was called to the square. It was called the Demokratia Platz for a view by the Germans. Anyone who remained in their home would be put to death immediately, would be executed. Your only chance of survival was coming to the square. You can't describe the fear that gripped every member of the ghetto to have that announcement on that day. Everybody knew that day they were the subject of a lottery. Right? That day would be the date of their fate. Would they survive, or was this the end? They would all pass under the staff of the wicked Hazam Shal Rotzkim Shiachatzur as Mishpatam Lachaim Alamavas. But the ghetto has Roknim Yishvehim. The homes of the ghetto are emptied of its inhabitants. Horim Hovilu as Yaldeim Akitanim. Parents dragged their young children. Ubanim Tamchu Vesadu as Avosehem. And children took their elderly parents. Shahocha Amishantam, who were infirm on their cane. Cholim Tashushay Koach Nisua Yidei B'nei Mishpachim. Now you picture the image. He's trying to describe that the intergenerational help. The parents were helping the young children who couldn't go on their own, and the children were helping the parents who had grown old and infirm who couldn't go on their own. Everyone was helping one another, but all responded to come to this lineup. Kulam holchu aloch yilechu b'koach l'migrash hazavuos. Kolos habachia hataniach. You heard the groans and the cries filled the air. Tanus la'uchalos kolos hashever hayagam v'hanachash nishmu mikol tzad. No one knew what our ends would be. But one thing we knew was that we've been lost, that we're experiencing absolute Gehenna. V'yom zeh hayayom sagvir v'sofa ha-geshem v'ashelag nitchu b'yachad min ha-shemayim ki'ilu yoshvei marom b'shmei aravos malachim mala m'sharsei kel olyon gam heim nifhalu nechbezu v'zeh olzeh sho'olim. The weather that day he describes was stormy. Snow and rain were coming from the heavens, as if the angels felt our terror, were begging God to show remnant mercy on the remnants of the Jewish people who were taken for their slaughter. The kacha hisatzvu al migrash hazeh, and this is how we gathered on this lot. Kol yoshvei ha-ghetto, shemanu az kishloshim elef, we were 30,000 people. Shechichu lo'ofato shel echad me'ametzachim ha-germanim shayadio l'shemtza b'shem Roka. This is how we were taken, 30,000 people waiting for the German murderer Roka, the Gestapo officer in charge of selection. It was up to him to seal the fate of the Jews. 30,000 people. Our shul has 800 families. Mm. So what are we, 3,000 people? Imagine. Montoya, Boca Raton Synagogue, the entire Boca community. 30,000 people waiting for the person who would hold their fate. And here's the part. That's just, it's mind-boggling. B'ma'amad zeh nigash elai Reb Eliyahu mivorsha, Hashem yikom demo. At that moment, there was a man who approached me. His name was Reb Eliyahu. He came from Warsaw. May God avenge his death. Echad me'apleitim shenimletu mivorsha lalita b'chafso mipelot l'nafsho. He was one of the survivors who came from Warsaw to Lithuania, escaping the German snare. Aval nafal menapach elapacha sharei gam lalita higia yadam hatmeya shelanatzim. So while he had run from Warsaw and made it to Lithuania, but now the Germans had come to Lithuania and they had caught up with him. He knew well the path, he knew well the behavior of the Nazis. He knew that of the 30,000 standing there, many of them would not live to see the next day. The next day, thousands would be taken for slaughter. So here, he turned to Rav Osher, this Jew, a simple Jew, Reb Eliyahu, from Warsaw. We don't even know his last name. A simple Jew, Reb Eliyahu, came from Warsaw, Lithuania, and 30,000 people in a lineup, mothers holding their babies, children helping their elderly parents stand, waiting for the lineup for the selection. He turns to Rav Osher and he says, Husha'alosi, Mahu anusach habracha shal mekatshe shmo yisbarach muto levar. What's the bracha to say when you're about to die al Kiddush Hashem? What's the proper bracha to say? That's what was on his mind. That's what he was thinking. Not where is Hashem? Not how could Hashem do this? Not there is no God if we could be enduring this? But what's the proper bracha to say on this mitzvah of giving our lives, of giving our lives to sanctify God's name? Hayim aleim levarach hashekichonam mitzvah v'tzivanu al Kiddush Hashem? Is the proper bracha al Kiddush Hashem? O aleim levarech lekadish es Hashem. Is it al Kiddush Hashem or lekadish Hashem? Vuhu amarli, and he said to me, ki hu rotzi ladas ba'atzmo ich levarech. The reason he's asking is, he realizes he himself might be killed. He wants to know himself what the proper bracha is. U'milvad zos hu rotzi lekayim mitzvah. And aside from that, he right now wants to do a mitzvah. Ulai ha'achrona bimei chayav. Maybe the last one of his life. Vihi, and what's that mitzvah? Lavor bein hapikudim lamavis ulelamdam kedas mala asosim tagia sha'atam achrona ulezakosim shivruchu ez abrocha kviyadin. At that lineup, with people crying and moaning, he wants to walk around and teach those who want to know what the bracha is to say. Because that will be his mitzvah in the last moment of his life. Teaching Jews how to die as Jews. How to die with a bracha of Kiddush Hashem on their lips. How to die for Judaism al Kiddush Hashem. Imagine the fact that a Jew in that circumstance is asking that question. Is he asking that question? These are five volumes of these questions. And I could have chosen from countless ones. You know, the Jew who says that I'm about to be murdered and they're going to throw me in a, I forgot what the circumstances, but I'm going to be buried in a non-Jewish cemetery. Is it better for me to be cremated than to be in a non-Jewish cemetery? That's what was on his mind. Mm. Another Jew who says, should I, the questions, I actually attached another question, which I don't know if we're going to have time for in a moment, but the bar mitzvah boy, we'll get to that actually, maybe we'll just squeeze it in at the end. This is, again, I'm not saying this is what should have been on their minds. I'm not judging someone that this was not on their mind. I'm saying that it's absolutely extraordinary that there were those who this was. And it can renew or restore or strengthen our sense of emuna. This is what they were willing to sacrifice and compromise and give up to be a Jew. They gave their very lives. And, you know, there, it's often said that Jews are too willing to give their, to die al Kiddush Hashem. We have the opportunity and the privilege to live al Kiddush Hashem. And their memory... And the remarkable memory of these stories should inspire our living on Kiddush Hashem. So what did he answer? The Sefer Yosef Ometz move on Nusach HaBracha Shemutal Mekach Hashem Levarich, and the Sefer Yosef Ometz quotes the language of the Bracha to recite. HaNusach HaVidu Eshel Mori Rabesher Mikila Kedusha Frankfurt Shekidus Hashem V'zehu Baruch Atah Hashem Lekenu Mecholam, blessed are you, God, our God, King of the Universe, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav, who has sanctified us with his mitzvos, V'tzivanu Le'ehov L'Hashem HaNichbad V'hanora, and who commanded us to love you, God, the honored name, the awesome name, Hahaya Hahove V'ha'asid Lios, who was, who is, and who will be, B'chol Levaveinu, with all of our heart, V'chol Nafshenu, with all of our soul, V'kadesh Shmo B'rabim, and to sanctify God's name publicly. Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh Shemcha Barabim. Blessed are you, God, Mekadesh Shemcha Barabim. Sanctifying your name in public. V'achar kach yomar, and then say, Shema Yisrael, V'maser Tzavaro Kiddush Shemo. You say Shema, and then whatever will be, you know, when Rabbi Akiva was being put to death by the Romans, he turned to his students, and he said that he says Shema every day, and he never knew if he'd have the opportunity to fulfill. Now, b'chol levavcha, love God with all of your heart, means to direct all of our emotion and our energy and our heart and our passion. B'chol me'odecha means with all of our resources, with whatever ma'od, whatever we cherish. But what about b'chol nafshecha, to give our lives? Rabbi Akiva smiled and he turned to his students and he said, of course this is not a mitzvah that we welcome or search out, but he turned to his students and he said, he has the opportunity to die al kiddush Hashem, that's b'chol nafshecha, and that's the language of this bracha. B'chol levaveinu u'v'chol nafshenu. B'shla, which is the Shnei Luchos HaBris, written by Rabbi Shai Horowitz, B'shla shar ha'osiyos, kasov sheyesh levarach b'nusach zeh, baruch atah Hashem, l'kadesh shemo barabim. Kedin harbe mitzvos aseh, shemavarchim al kiyumam, v'ayin sham shekasov, gam kein atam, lama mavarchim l'kadesh, v'ayin mavarchim al. And here it gets into the technicality of, do you make the bracha l'kadesh, Shema Barabim, or Al Kiddush Hashem, when do you make a Leh? Right? What's the bracha that you say Friday night when you light candles? Lahadlik Nirshal Shabbos. That's Leh. Yet we say Al Mitzvahs this, Al Mitzvahs that. So when do you say Leh? When do you say Al? So he says, when the mitzvah can be accomplished through someone else, through agency, so then the bracha is Al. When the mitzvah has to be done by you, it can only be done by you, then it has to be Leh. And therefore he concludes the Shla. Since giving up one's life is obviously something you're doing yourself, it should be with the lamet le, le kadesh shemo. So, and he quotes the Pesach Etshuva, who agrees. Umikol zeheresi, I'm on the third paragraph. Because of all of this, says Rav Oshri, I ruled, shalafi dati yesh levarch kfi nusach shel ashla. That's in fact the language you should use, le kadesh shemo barabim. The akadosh hazeh rebel Yahu, and this holy Jew, rebel Yahu, this holy Jew, Hashem yikom damo, may Hashem avenge his blood. Shina v'shilesh es ha'nusach hazeh shel ha'bracha, he repeated it over and over. V'limeid ko gam le'yehudim achirim, and he walked around the ghetto on this black day, teaching whoever wanted to learn the language of the bracha. Mishunenes u'mechudedes b'fihim, so that of the 30,000 Jews who would be selected and killed that day, who gave their lives al kiddush Hashem, he taught them the bracha to recite on this mitzvah of giving their lives. Shiyadu eich levarch shtagiyah shaitam chas v'shalom lamos mavis kedoshim. V'achare eiz azman, and says Rabbi Oshri as a postscript to the story, after some time, boy la shuva kadosh anal v'siper li shagam agon Rav Chanan Wasserman gam hu limit his beno, Rav Naftali. The Rav Chanan Wasserman, the great Rav Chanan, a student of the Chavetz Chaim, taught his son Rav Naftali, who was killed by the Nazis, this same language of the bracha, that before they were murdered, they said the bracha l'kadesh shema barabim. I share this with you not to get into the details of which bracha, why bracha, how bracha, you know, what's the mindset, how could a person even have the mindset to make a bracha. I share it again just as an example of spiritual resistance, that in the concentration camp the Nazis could take away the physical dignity, but there were Jews who were able to. There are stories of Pesach and Seder in the concentration camps, and these stories of spiritual resistance should give us strength and should give us emuna. You know, I remember on one of the, I was on Three March of the Livings, so on one of them, one of the teenagers who have really the most poignant insights and these moments had a great insight. They said, you know, the Nazis sought to dehumanize. They gave everybody a number and they shaved the head. they took away, you know, a person's hair is their hairstyle. That's how a person is human. A person's name is their individuality. You give a number and you shave a head. The goal was to dehumanize, to take away the humanity. And this teenager said, you know, they did take away the humanity and they turned them into angels. Because a human being is defined by food, by comfort, by luxury, by the physical world. And by removing and withholding all of that from these souls, they turned these into camps that housed angels, souls who almost didn't have a body. And I thought it was such an interesting insight. Many of these souls, really asked and observed the most outstanding things. We'll look quickly at one more. Yes, please.
Can I share a personal
story? Yeah, please, please.
Absolutely.
Please.
My mother, who's a survivor, was liberated from Bergen-Belsen. And she's a Polish Jew. And at the time, you know, I didn't think of it as spiritual resistance until now, until listening to you speak. But she was assigned a job in Bergen-Belsen with a few of her friends. And they were quote-unquote nurses, which basically meant that they would enter the bunks and their job was to pull out the dead bodies with people who had just died during the night or who were sick or whatever. And that was the nursing that they did. And the three of them had decided that they made a pact among themselves. And the pact was that if any of the three of them should die, they basically, the way they dragged the bodies out was by the feet, because that was the easiest, you know, that was the easiest way for them to do it. But they decided that if any of them should die, they would carry them by the head, by the shoulders. And my mother told this story to Ruffel Berman, who, you know, she uses part of her Chevra Kedisha program, because apparently part of the process in the whole Tahara is that the head of the dead person is cradled throughout the whole Tahara process. So although they didn't know that that was a dignified way to do a Tahara, if they didn't know the rules of Tahara, but instinctively they knew that that was dignified, and they made this pact among themselves. I mean, these were like 19-year-old girls.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, thinking about, you talk about spiritual resistance, that I see it in a different...
Yeah,
different,
no, absolutely. That's an amazing story. 100%. It's an amazing story. Resistance is saying, I'm not going to let you define me, and I'm not going to just passively do whatever, but to maintain a sense of identity, of holiness, of consciousness, even in that dark place. Let's look at one more question. Again, I said there's five volumes of just extraordinary questions. This is an unbelievable one. In the ghetto, Kishayinu be'emek ha'bacha, be'gei ha'hariga, nochachnu l'dash, shekol ikar kavanas ha'gemanam ha'arim, ha'isa limchos me'itanu as tzelem elokim. He says, well, we were in the dark valley of tears of the ghetto. We knew that the Germans' whole motive was to remove from us any sense of Tzelem Elokim. Ulharos lefnei ha'olam kulo sheyehudim einam b'chalal amin ha'enoshi. To say that Jews are subhuman. Ukebehemos nidmu. And are animals. Sheko shofech damam yinakeh ve'ein alav chet. Right? Nobody thinks it's immoral that you're wearing a belt or you're sitting on a leather chair. Killing an animal is not an act of immorality. So killing a Jew is not immoral because a Jew is an animal. They're less than a human. That was the modus operandi, says Rav Oshri, of the Germans. And to advance that agenda, they tried to remove from the inhabitants of the ghetto any sense of hope whatsoever, so that it would be an environment of hopelessness, that Jews would stop seeing themselves as human beings, and they would go like sheep to the slaughter. And because, says Rav Oshri, because I understood that that was their MO, I wanted to offset it by, in the ghetto, girding myself and strengthening myself to give chizuk to everyone that they are humans and they have value and they are tzelem elokim. To give them a sense of hope. Can you imagine he's walking around the ghetto saying that God will return from this anger the kolenu yishma, and he will hear our cries. V'yichon v'lo yitashna b'yad oyveinu, and he will not abandon us to the hands of our enemies. Limchos hashmeinu, to erase our names. U'min hashamayim yabit, from heavens he will see. V'yireh v'yasa chesed imanu, v'lo ya'acha yishuaseinu l'petus nafsheinu. You know, I have been quoting often recently the Piazetzner Rebbe. The Piazetzner Rebbe, Klanimus Kalman Shapiro, was in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he was like the default, de facto rabbi there. And he gave sermons that were transcribed and buried. And he was murdered by the Nazis. He was shot with his children. Terrible story. He had one son. It's an unbelievable story. But his sermons were recovered and published. They're called Esh Kodesh, Holy Fire. Rabbi Moshe Weinberger Shul in Woodmere was named for the Piazetzner Rebbe and for his work Esh Kodesh. It was published, it was translated in English. Can you imagine getting up on Shabbos and giving sermons every week in the Warsaw Ghetto? Is there a greater spiritual resistance than giving a sermon, a drasha, a Dvar Torah on the Parsha in the Warsaw Ghetto? So here Rav Oshri, who's in the Kovna Ghetto, says he took upon himself to try to restore a sense of hope. It's not over. There is a God who'll hear our voices. Aragtani lazos tiferes bachurim. And to try to advance this, he says, I organized a group of young boys. Vasafti bachurei chemed gedolim uktanim. I chose good boys, young and old. Kidei lulamdam bina vadas torah v'yira tahora. Because I wanted to show there's a sense of hope, we're going to survive. And, you know, there's a story of it's not the Klezenberg Rebbe. It's who's the other Rebbe? You know, she wrote Yaffa Eliach's book, quotes him all the time. It's escaping me at the moment. But there was this big question. They had managed to bake some matzah. But there was a kezias only enough for one person to eat. There was a big question about who should eat the kezias of matzah. And a girl turned to the Rebbe and said, give it to a child, because if someone will survive, it will be the children, and they will need to know what matzah tastes like. Mm. And the Rebbe ended up doing that, and he survived the war, and he married that girl. Mm. And they restarted a family together. So Rav Oshri also is trying to give children a sense of faith and hope, and if they will survive, they'll need to know something. They'll need to know some Torah. Lintor b'socham chaye olam, he wants to plant within them, lasam b'libam ahavaso v'yiraso, a love of Hashem, and awe of Him, lasos ritzono la'avdo b'leiv shalem, in the Kovna Ghetto. So in my yeshiva in the Kovna Ghetto, trying to teach children so when they survive they will know. Hitztayein na'ar, there was an amazing boy, mimishpachas Sharavshavsky, shebekovna. Sheis maser b'chol ma'odo v'nafsho lul matorah, he applied himself with everything he had, even in the Kovna Ghetto, to learn. Ulamarosha adayin lo yigil mitzvos, and though he was not yet bar mitzvah, b'chol zos hayachadar ava v'yirak ezakin v'rogil, nevertheless, he had such mature love and awe of God, like he was a sophisticated, mature person. Even though he was a young boy, he was scrupulous and vigilant with mitzvos, as if he was a mature boy. You ready for this question? And this beloved young boy turned to me in the Kovna Ghetto, and he asked the following. He says, you know, Rebbe, I'm never going to make it to my bar mitzvah. They're going to kill me. We're all going to die, and it's unlikely, it's possible, it's unlikely I'm going to make it to my bar mitzvah. And I cannot imagine dying without knowing what it's like to wear tefillin. So Rebbe, though I'm not yet bar mitzvah, can I wear tefillin? Because I can't go to my death not knowing what it's like to wear tefillin. This is what he asks. U'kishashamati miyelet sh'ashuam zeh davar she'il aso. And when I heard from this precious child, his question, Nazlu Eine Dmaos, my eyes filled with tears, Vamarti Balibi, and I said in my heart, as Divri Akina Shekonin Yirmiyahu Anavi Bishaito, the words of Yirmiyahu Anavi, who witnessed the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, Mi Yitain Roshi Mayim, Ve'eni Mekordima, Ve'evke Yomam Valayla, Eschalalai Basami, Ki Alamavis Bechalalainu, Baba Aminoseinu, Lahakris Olo Michutz Bachurim Erechavos. And so he goes through the whole question. I didn't even put the whole question here. And he ends up concluding at the end that, of course, this boy who is mature and sophisticated and capable of protecting and showing the proper dignity to tefillin, that absolutely this Sharashevsky boy who had demonstrated fear of Hashem, was a student, aware and capable of maintaining the degree of bodily cleanliness. Since he was 3 months short of his 13th birthday, I relied on the prevailing custom Although I had ruled that he could don the tefillin, even though he was still a minor, I warned him if he find himself with 9 other Jewish men who wanted to count him as a minion, he was obligated to tell them that he was not yet bar mitzvah. So we had an example of an older gentleman from Warsaw to Lithuania who wanted to know what's the bracha to say before you give your life, and a 12-year-old boy who says, Rebbe, if everything goes the way it's going, I'm not going to live to my bar mitzvah. I cannot die without putting tefillin on. Is it okay to wear tefillin? I said this to a group of boys who leave their tefillin in school on Sundays. So you know what? Think about this boy and put your tefillin on even for a couple. Never miss a day. Think about this boy and never miss a day. Is it why we should wear tefillin? It's not trying to give a guilt trip. It's not education through guilt. That's not using the Holocaust to be manipulative. What I wanted to just share with you today on the eve of Yom HaShoah is the chizuk that we can draw by remembering the incredible, incredible spiritual resistance and the emunah through love and the emunah through anger of that survivor, that woman who was so angry at God her whole life, which was an amazing, amazing display of emunah. To be so angry at God means you so believe He exists and you so expected more from Him. That's why you're so angry at Him. So I encourage you to come tonight. I think, as I wrote about last week, you know, whether you agree or disagree, Yom HaShoah, no Yom HaShoah, as long as we have survivors, Yom HaShoah is about showing them honor. So we, Baruch Hashem, have survivors. Please join us tonight for our Yom HaShoah program. And again, thank you to Esti Lupin for opening up her home.